But now joining us, another one of our favorites. And if Pastor Nicholas Wright is America's pastor, this has got to be America's historian. And I mean that. I really mean that. William Federer is a fantastic advocate for the true history of what we have seen and how that impacts today. And his knowledge is just almost without peer, him being able to discuss it. Of course, his website, AmericanMinute.com. He's written many books. One of the books that we'll discuss today is There Really Is a Santa Claus, a little bit about the history of that. We'll get into that. We'll talk about a very important anniversary tomorrow. But let me welcome him. William Federer, welcome back to the Power Hour.
Daniel, great to be with you.
Absolutely. Now, tomorrow is probably, you know, we know July 4th. That's a pretty obviously famous day everybody knows about. But tomorrow is an even bigger day as far as nobody knows about it. December 15th is the anniversary of the Bill of Rights. We will talk about that a little later. Christmas is right around the corner. Maybe, what should we start with your book? Let's start with your book about Santa Claus and Christmas.
Right. So the title is There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. And go way back in time, St. Nicholas lived in Greece in the area of what is today Turkey. Matter of fact, Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. He is to the Greeks what St. Patrick is to the Irish, what St. Peter is to Roman Catholics. So there's more Eastern Orthodox churches named after St. Nicholas than anybody else. The story begins during the Roman Empire period of time. There's 10 major persecutions of Christians, and the government is persecuting Christians. I know that's hard to imagine. And the 10th persecution was the worst, Diocletian. He actually wanted to exterminate Christianity. This is the setting for when Nicholas lived. And his parents died and left him a lot of money. He was born in the 280s. And the movement that swept through Christianity at this time is called Pietism. It leads to the monasticism movement. But Pietism, this was this thought, if you really become a Christian, you are expected to give away all your money and join a monastery. And so Nicholas inherits the money from his parents. They had died. And he decides to give it away to the poor, but he wants to do it anonymously, so he sneaks into town at nighttime and throws the money in the window of poor people. This way, God alone gets the credit, and nobody knows about him. And so a famous story was a merchant in the town of Patara, Asia Minor, had gone bankrupt. And back then, the creditors would not only come and take your house and lands, they would take your children. And this was, you know, the trafficking, forced marriages, terrible stuff. And this merchant thought if he could hurry up and marry his three daughters off, the creditors couldn't take him. Unfortunately, the merchant did not have money for a dowry, which was needed in that area of the world for a legally recognized wedding. Nicholas hears the problem. Late one night, throws a bag of money in the window. It provides the dowry. The oldest daughter can get married. And then throws another bag in later for the second daughter. When he gets to the third daughter, the dad is expecting it. He's waiting up. And when the money comes in the window, supposedly it lands in a shoe or a stocking that's drying by the fireplace, the dad runs outside and catches Nicholas. And Nicholas makes the father promise not to tell where the money came from. And so this was the origin of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which was December 6, 343 AD. Now there's more to the story. After he gives away his money, he does go to the Holy Land. He's going to join a monastery of Zion. But somehow the Lord tells him not to hide his light under a bushel. On his way back, he stops off at the Church of the Nativity. And so the picture of Santa Claus kneeling at the little crib, there's a little historical source for that. Now, Mark Twain visited the Holy Land and wrote a book about it called Innocents Abroad, published 1869. He visited the Church of the Nativity, and Mark Twain wrote, "This spot where the first Merry Christmas was uttered in all the world, and from whence the friend of my childhood, Santa Claus, departed on his first journey to gladden and continue to gladden the roaring firesides on wintry mornings in many a distant land forever and forever." Anyway, so Nicholas goes back to Asia Minor, today that's Turkey, gets off at a busy city called Myra, and unbeknownst to him, the bishop had died. Church leaders couldn't decide who the next bishop was going to be. and one of them has a dream that the first person to church the next day would be named Nicholas, and he was to be their bishop. And so sure enough, he comes there, they break the news to him. He was not too excited about being a bishop because the Roman Emperor Diocletian was arresting bishops and killing them. So it was sort of like, you be the bishop. No, I insist, you first. No, you be the bishop. And anyway, Nicholas becomes the bishop. He is arrested. He's in jail awaiting death. But then the Emperor Diocletian is struck with an intestinal disease, so painful, he abdicates the throne. He steps down on May 1st, 305 A.D. And you have to appreciate the poetic humor. Emperors by this time had been declaring themselves a god and demanding that their image be worshipped. And so this was sort of like a god resigning. And the next emperor is Galerius. He continues the persecution of Christians. He's struck with an intestinal disease. He dies in 311 A.D. And so it's a toss-up in Rome with no emperor. And four generals fight it out, and one of them is named Constantine. He's in York, Britain. When the news comes that the emperor died, his soldiers surround him and say, "Hail Caesar," and he marches with his army to Rome. Now, in Rome is General Maxentius, and there's the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. They're going to fight it out, and now it's October 28, 312 A.D., and Constantine reportedly sees the sign of Christ in the sky, puts it on all of his shields and symbols. He wins and afterwards stops the persecution of Christians. What was the sign of Christ? Well, it's the first two letters of the Greek name for Christ. And so Christ is a Greek name, and the first letter that makes the K sound is written as an X, and it's called the Chi. The second letter that makes the R sound is called Rho, and it's written as a big P. And so the Chi Rho is the X and the P, the first two Greek letters for the name of Christ. And so if you look at the 4th century Roman Christian artwork, you'll see the big X and the big P. It's called the Chi Rho. Over the centuries, it got shortened just to the Chi, the X, and it was called the Christ's Cross or Christ Cross, Christ meaning Christ. And that is where we get the X-MAS, like Xmas. And you think, oh, they crossed out Christ. No, that's the Greek letter that stood for Christ. It also became a part of a written oath. So if you're going to swear on a document, you would sign at the Christ's cross. Today, that's come down to sign at the X. Or cross my heart, swear to tell the truth. Or they would kiss it to show sincerity after they signed. And so that's the X's and the O's on the bottom of a Valentine. The X, to promise before Christ, you're going to keep your pledge to this person, and the O is sincerity, but instead of the kiss. Anyway, the Chi Rho. So now it's 313 A.D. Constantine issues the Edict of Milan and ends the persecution of Christians. This is the first time in history that Christians are not being persecuted by the government. And at this time, Constantine has let Nicholas out of jail. So Nicholas, since it's okay to be a Christian, he preaches publicly against paganism and sexual immorality and Diana worship. What's that? Well, nearby at Ephesus is the temple to Diana. It's one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It's twice as big as the Parthenon on the Acropolis in Athens, which, if you've ever been to Athens, is this enormous Greek temple on top of the hill. Well, the temple to Diana was twice as big. It had 127 huge pillars and temple prostitutes. It was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean. And the Apostle Paul preached against Diana worship in Acts chapter 19. And so Nicholas preaches against Diana worship, and his followers get stirred up enough to tear the temple to Diana down. And so Nicholas would have been a fire and brimstone type preacher. During this time, the Greek Olympics are ended. Why? Well, they're pagan, and they competed without clothes. They go and get into it all. It was just a race, a javelin throw, and wrestling matches, but this was considered pagan. And so the Christian Roman Empire now gets rid of them. And Nicholas preaches against exposure of unwanted infants. What's that? In the Roman society, a woman would bury the child, lay it at the father's feet, If the father picked it up and liked it, they kept it. But if the father did not pick it up, the mother had to put the baby in a basket and set it outside, expose it to the elements, and it would die. Called exposure of unwanted infants. And a lot of the early Christians would hear the babies crying and rescue them. This is where we get the story of a mother putting her baby in a basket in front of an old couple's house and knocking on the door and running away, and the couple comes out and sees the baby in the basket. And anyway, it was the Roman version of abortion, and Nicholas preached against this. So he would have been a pro-life preacher today. Anyway, then the first...
Wow, hold that thought, William. There's the music on the break. I mean, you've gone the whole time. This is fantastic. Fantastic. Other side, AmericanMinute.com, William Federer, ThePowerHour.com. Stay tuned. Really interesting discussion with William Federer. He is, without a doubt, one of the top historians of our day. AmericanMinute.com is the website. You were talking about the original Santa Claus, St. Nicholas. Why don't you continue on? We'll just go right on from there.
Right. Well, St. Nicholas, again, is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. Once Constantine legalizes Christianity for the Roman Empire, a heresy starts called Arianism. A guy named Arius said Jesus was a little less than God, a created being, and the heresy splits the church and the Roman Empire, because Constantine had more or less made Christianity the de facto religion of the empire. And so Constantine, he's like, look, I don't understand theology. You bishops get together and settle it. So he pays for all the Christian bishops to come to Nicaea. First time ever that all the Christian leaders from around the world come to one spot, and they settle it with the Nicene Creed. Now, the tradition is that Nicholas was so upset at Arius for starting the Arian heresy that Nicholas slapped him across the face at the conference. So jolly old St. Nick had a little temper there. You better watch out if he's coming to town, right? And then Nicholas not only confronted heretics, he confronted corrupt politicians. So there was a story of a Roman governor. He was corrupt. He was going to use some soldiers as innocent as scapegoats and blame them and have them executed. When Nicholas hears about it, he rushes down to the crowd, breaks through, grabs the executioner's sword, throws it down, and then publicly tells everybody what the corrupt governor did. And the governor realizes nobody could know all these details other than God, and so his number's up, and he begs Nicholas to pray for him. Greeks have lots of stories of Nicholas. Now, I mentioned those three bags of gold that were thrown in the window. That led to Nicholas being considered the quote-unquote patron saint of pawnbrokers. That's right. Pawnbroker shops will hang three gold balls out the front or have it on their signs. Those three gold balls represent the three bags of gold that Nicholas threw in the window. And the pawnbrokers say, we help people and families out in their time of financial need. You know, it's a little bit of a stretch. But Nicholas is also considered the patron saint of sailors. Now, where does that come from? So Myra, being a port city, had a storm. Sailors, fishermen couldn't get back. They get Nicholas to come. He prays. The sea becomes calm. Sort of like Jesus come on the water. And another story is Nicholas, there's a famine, and his people are starving. He goes down to the dock, talks some sailors into unloading their grain to feed his people, promising God would bless them for doing it. On their return trip, they said that the grain that was left in their boat had multiplied, like Elijah and the story of the little widow with the meal barrel that didn't run empty. And so he dies December 6, 343 A.D., He's so popular that the Justinian, the Roman emperor, builds a cathedral, names it after him. But then in 988 A.D., Vladimir the Great of Russia, he decides to get rid of paganism, throws all the pagan idols in the Dnieper River. He's going to embrace monotheism, hasn't chosen yet which one. Muslims show up. In the first chronicle of Russia, their court document said Vladimir listened intently when the Muslims told him that paradise was filled full of virgins because he was fond of women. But when they told him he could no longer drink alcohol, Vladimir said, we cannot have this because drink is the joy of the Rus', the Russian. So I think it's humorous that Russia didn't convert to Islam because Vladimir liked to drink. Anyway, the Greek Orthodox send ambassadors, and they say, look, we speak Greek, the language of the New Testament. Our land is where John spoke and Paul spoke. And the largest church in Christendom for 1,000 years was in the Greek area. It was the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. So Vladimir converts to Greek Orthodox Christianity, and he adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. That's why so many people in Russia are named Nicholas or Nikolai. But then the Muslims invade. And in the year 1087, they're destroying churches and graves, and they're getting close to Myra, and the Christians don't want the grave of their famous St. Nicholas destroyed. So they move it over to Italy, a little town on the coast called Bari, B-A-R-I, and the Pope dedicates a church. The Pope is named Urban II, and people may not be up on their Pope names, but that's the same Urban II a few years later, goes to the Council of Clermont and begs the European kings to send help to these Greeks that are being killed by the invading Muslims. They send help. It's called the First Crusade. So the same pope that welcomes the St. Nicholas traditions to Western Europe is the pope that calls for the First Crusade to rescue the Greeks. Anyway, now that Nicholas his traditions are in Italy, the gift-giving catches on. Now, it is sort of interesting. In a backward sense, we may not even have a Santa Claus in the West if it was not for Islamic jihad in the East. So we have the fundamental Islam to thank for us having a Santa Claus. the gift-giving.
Let's stop on that note. There's the music. On the other side, more with William Federer. We'll get into this and so much more. Tomorrow is an important anniversary. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. AmericanMinute.com. Getting back to William. So, William, fantastic story about St. Nicholas, about Nicholas. How did then he turn into Santa Claus? Let's discuss that.
Well, a couple things. One, Martin Luther starts the Reformation, and he outlaws all the saints' days in Protestant countries, including the popular St. Nicholas Day. And the Germans like the gift-giving, so he decides to move all the gift-giving to December 25th. And he says all gifts come from the Christ child. And the German pronunciation of Christ child is Christkindl, like kindergarten, kindercare. Kindle means child. And so Christkindl ended up being pronounced Kris Kringle. So Kris Kringle is really Christkindl, means Christ child. Then we look at England and Henry VIII. Brings the Reformation there, not because he had a spiritual experience, he just wanted another wife, and the Pope wouldn't recognize his divorce, he makes himself his own Pope, but at Christmas, during Henry VIII, turns into this party time. And if you remember, Mardi Gras used to be the day before Lent, when you would fast 40 days before Easter, and now Mardi Gras is a lewd party in New Orleans. It's sort of what happened with Christmas in England, drinking, wassailing, carousing. So when the Puritans took over England in 1642, they outlawed Christmas. They said it's too worldly. And then pilgrims and Puritans that settled Massachusetts actually had a 5-shilling fine for anybody caught celebrating Christmas. But the Dutch loved St. Nicholas, and the Dutch settled New York, and they brought over the Nicholas traditions. Now, the important understanding that most people are familiar with the Catholic saying, St. Peter is at the gates of heaven. Well, the Greeks have a saying based on the book of Revelation, where it says Jesus will return at the end of the world to judge the living and the dead, riding a white horse. And the saints will come back with him, riding white horses. And St. Nicholas is a saint, so he'll be one of those riding a white horse. But to the Greeks, he gets to come back once a year for a little mini-judgment, a little checkup on the kids, make sure they're on the right track, see who's naughty, see who's nice. Saints come from where? Heaven, the celestial city, New Jerusalem, that turns into the North Pole. In Norway, they didn't have horses, so they got them riding a reindeer. And the Lamb's Book of Life and Book of Works turns into the Book of the Naughty and the Nice, and the angels turn into the elves, so you can sort of see how it gets off track. But in Holland, to this day, they still have St. Nicholas coming once a year, dressed as a bishop, riding a white horse. And he gives presents to the good kids, but to the naughty kids, he has a little helper, Zwarte Peter. He's a Moor, a Muslim. And they tell the naughty kids that Zwarte Piet will put you in a gunny sack, take you back to Spain, and sell you into Muslim slavery. Muslims controlled Spain for 700 years and enslaved over 1 million Europeans. There were entire Catholic orders in Europe through the Middle Ages called the Trinitarian, and the head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations to ransom back your friend. So often you'd tell a little kid that St. Nicholas is coming, he'd start crying. And I talked to one guy from Holland. He said, yeah, all the little boys in his neighborhood would go to sleep the night before St. Nicholas visited with a pocket knife in their pocket. I said, why is that? He goes, that's to cut ourselves out of the gunny sack in case of RKP took us. But so the Dutch settled New Amsterdam, which became New York, and they did bring over their St. Nicholas traditions. And actually, the name for St. Nicholas, if you say it in the Dutch, it comes out Sant Nicolaas. So Santa Claus is basically the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas. And so in New York, Washington Irving, we know him because of the Legend of Sleepy Hollow with Rip Van Winkle, and he named the city in New York Gotham City. So Washington Irving writes about Nicholas visiting the Dutch children in New York once a year, and he describes St. Nicholas not dressed as a bishop, but in a typical Dutch outfit of long trunk hose, a leather belt, boots, and a stocking hat. But he's still called St. Nicholas. And then in New York, it's Clement Moore. And his family donates land for an Episcopal seminary. He teaches Hebrew there. And there's a park at 10th and 22nd in New York called the Clement Moore Park. Well, he writes a poem for his children in 1823 titled A Visit from St. Nicholas. It was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. So he's still St. Nicholas, but he's shrunk. And now he's a right jolly, plump old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. But then, two more quickly, Civil War starts. And Harper's Weekly magazine has an illustrator named Thomas Nast. We know him because he invented the Republican elephant and the Democrat mule. Well, he has a cover of St. Nicholas talking to the Union troops, sitting on his wagon full of toys, and in the background is a North Pole sign. This is actually the first time that there's a North Pole sign. This was a political jab at the Confederate South during the Civil War to say St. Nicholas belongs to the North. But and then early 1900s, Coca-Cola. They pioneered mass marketing. It's the best trademark name in the world. And they hire an artist in 1930 named Haddon Sunblum. We know him because he invented the Quaker Oats Man and Aunt Jemima syrup. And he does a painting of Santa Claus drinking Coke every year for 33 years. And this becomes the most recognizable image of Santa Claus. He's full grown again, nice huggable grandfather and rosy cheeks. But if you go back to the beginning, there really was a guy who lived in Asia Minor, today that's Turkey, in the 4th century. He loved Jesus enough to give away his money to the poor. He kept his faith when he was in Roman prison. He stood for the doctrine of the Trinity, had little tempers, smacked Harriet. He preached against sexual immorality, pagan temples, corrupt politicians, and he was generous and gave to the poor, but he wanted to do it anonymously because he wanted the credit to go to God and not to himself. So it's a really fascinating story. It's all in the book. There really is a Santa Claus, the history of St. Nicholas and Christmas holiday traditions.
That was amazing. I'm totally enthralled. It really has changed my perspective on Christmas. You know, there's a lot of pagan things that seem to be intertwined with it and whole history and what have you. But that really helps me appreciate it. It's fantastic. We only got about a minute or so before the break. We have one segment coming up on the other side. Tomorrow is a very important anniversary. Why don't you tell everybody what that is? And on the other side, let's discuss really how important that is, why it's important.
Well, it's the Bill of Rights Day, and that was where there was 10 handcuffs put on the federal government. But if I have a second, I'll throw in, during Henry VIII's time in England, he brings back an old Roman holiday, Saturnalia, because Britain used to be a Roman colony since the time of Julius Caesar. And so Saturn was their god of feasting and plenty and merriment. If you ever saw the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens, there's the spirit of Christmas present. He's a big fat guy, robe, wreath in his hair, goblet of wine, sort of the happy party guy. And you're looking at him asking yourself, who is he? He sort of looks like Santa, but he also looks like some Roman god. Well, that was Saturn, but they Christianized him and called him Father Christmas. They couldn't call him St. Nicholas because St. Nicholas was sort of outlawed. And so this gives you an idea of where some of those other threads that came in. But again, the Puritans took over England and outlawed all that. And it wasn't until the Dutch settled New York that St. Nicholas sort of had came back. But yes, tomorrow, December 15th, Bill of Rights Day, and the whole purpose of this was to put handcuffs on the federal government so it wouldn't turn into a big centralized monster like King George
the
Third was.
There's the music on the other side. Bill of Rights Day. We'll get a little background on that. Most important day. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. AmericanMinute.com, ThePowerHour.com. I've told the story often. I'll tell it many more times. My grandfather, as a little child, asked me, "Danny, do you know what separates America from every country in the world?" I, of course, said no. And he said, "Because in America, your rights come from God, not man, and man cannot take them." William Federer is the historian that we're talking about. He's been on, talked about that perspective many times, how truly unique America is. And of all these things, he's written a book called Backfired, which is talking about the religion of tolerance. The tolerance of our founding fathers is now not being tolerated in the country that founded it and the principles that founded it. Pretty ironic. In the middle of all this is stands the Bill of Rights. You know, if you're going to make a list of the most important documents ever written, you won't get too far before you come to this Bill of Rights. And tomorrow is Bill of Rights Day. And William Federer, maybe discuss that, discuss your book a little bit. How significant historically are the Bill of Rights?
Well, I bring out in my writings that the most common form of government in world history is what? It's kings. From Nimrod, Tower of Babel, 2,000 years of Egyptian pharaohs, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, Russian czars, King of Spain, France, and Austria, and communist dictators. Power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. And as the centuries of history go on, the kingdoms get bigger and bigger and bigger. Why? Because with military advancements, you can kill more people, right? Iron's stronger than bronze. But clearly there's a global goal in mind. So like that fractal, that five, that circle that keeps getting bigger and bigger, right? And so there's this global quest to rule the world. And it's inside of human nature. What do I mean? From Cain killing Abel to you put some babies in a playpen, one takes the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one's the bully hogging the ball. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some people in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. You put some people in the inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. And it's a hierarchical system. If you're friends with the king, you're more equal. If you're not friends with the king, you're less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. Or you're a slave. And so it's this pyramid structure to society. Everybody wants to get close to this guy at the top. And when America's founder got a chance to break away from the King of England, he was a globalist. I mean, he controlled 13 million square miles, a half a billion people, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, Canada, and America. And so America's founders basically flipped it. And instead of the government ruled from the top down, it's ruled from the bottom up. It's a polarity change in world government. That's what our founders gave us. And so we, the people, together, we're all co-kings. The word citizen means co-king. It's a co-regent, a co-sovereign. And so kings have subjects within what you're subjected to the will of the king. And citizens are in charge. So it's the bottom-up form of government. And so America breaks away from the King of England, and you had two competing views. One wanted a stronger centralized government so we could have an army and navy that could stand up against the King of England and the King of France or whatever. But the other group wanted a weaker central government so we wouldn't repeat the errors of a king who appoints all the judges and And so that's the struggle. It was called the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And then it turned into, Alexander Hamilton wanting to have a stronger federal government, Thomas Jefferson wanting a weaker federal government. So you can sort of trace it back to the beginning of the party system. And so even though the names of the parties have oscillated and changed over time, you basically see these two groups. One wanted a bigger central government, and usually during times of war, and the other one's a weaker federal government. And this is highlighted during World War II. when FDR had an unprecedented concentration of power. And then Eisenhower gets in, and he's trying to undo some of it. And there's a great quote Eisenhower gave in 1957. He said, "The federal government is the creature of the states. Yet Frankenstein-like, the creature wants to destroy its creators." So the 13 states created the federal government, but now the federal government wants to basically erase the 13 states and rule, you know, top down. And so it comes down. The very first government in America is called the Articles of Confederation. And it was 13 states, and the federal government, to use that term, was really powerless. It could raise no taxes other than what the states chose to give them. So they really couldn't have money for an army or a navy, and then there wasn't any resolution to interstate crises. You know, each state had their own currency, and there were trade wars and taxes between states. And so George Washington calls basically for the Constitutional Convention. George Washington is presiding over it, and they write our U.S. Constitution. And somebody that was there refused to sign the U.S. Constitution. His name is George Mason. Who's he? He's the one who took Washington's place in the Continental Congress. When Washington went on to become the general, he vacated his Virginia spot. It was filled by George Mason. And he was the richest man in Virginia. And anyway, he is called the father of the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And so imagine this. Here's George Washington, the father of the country, and he's overseeing this Constitution, and you're not going to vote for the Constitution. And George Mason ends up getting a whole bunch of the states to threaten not to ratify the Constitution. And it wasn't until the states buckled and said, okay, in the very first session of Congress, we will put handcuffs on this new federal government to keep it from becoming a Frankenstein like King George III. And so they did the very first session of Congress. They proposed 12, and the states, so the Congress came up with 12 of them, but only 10 of them got ratified by the states. And so
this is what we call
the Bill of Rights. And I love the preamble to the Bill of Rights. It says, "The conventions of a number of states at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed their desire that in order to prevent an abuse of its powers, further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added." So it makes it really clear. The purpose of the First Amendment are to put 10 handcuffs on the power of the federal government to prevent it becoming abusive in its power. Anyway, so the book Backfire, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance, No Longer Tolerates Religion, covers some of this.
Oh, this is fantastic. Would it be hyperbole to say that this was politically probably the most momentous time in American history, from the Declaration of Independence to the Bill of Rights? This politically is historically probably the greatest moment maybe ever.
Right. When you compare it to the rest of the world, where you have Chinese emperors, Muslim sultans, the czars in Russia, African chieftains, King of Spain, France, and Austria, the whole world is king. And here we are, having the people rule ourselves, and we want a limited government. It truly is unique on planet Earth, what took place.
Wow. William Federer, here he is, just fantastic. AmericanMinute.com is his website. His book, Backfired, you can get there. And also about the history of Christmas and St. Nicholas. Very good. William, absolute pleasure, my friend.
Daniel, thanks for having me on.